Now we're going to finish our day with the Antoine Lacassagne Prize, which this year will be given to Rafael Rodriguez from the Curie Institute. So this was decided by the professors of biology of the Collège de France. It goes back to Antoine Lacassagne, who was a professor of oncology and later of experimental medicine, and who received a big prize from the United Nations and donated it to the college to establish a lecture that would be given once a year or once every other year. Two lectures, actually, supposedly in French, so, but today it will be in English. And just to remind the audience, of your achievements. You're 41, you're currently a group leader at the CNRS at Institut Curie. You were trained in Marseille and Oxford, and I think in Cambridge also after that. And you have really established a new field at the frontier between chemistry, cell biology, and pharmacology. Really a very rich zone in which you have provided number of breakthroughs, including the ability to visualize, I'm sure you're going to show it, small molecules that act where we don't believe that they act. And you have been able recently to dive into unprecedented mechanism of action of small molecules, including many anti-cancer drugs. And more recently, you've been interested in revising iron homeostasis, and notably in the field of stress response. You've been recognized recently as a fellow of the Royal Society of Chemistry, and more recently, the Louis D. Prize from the Institut de France. So it's a great pleasure, again, on the behalf of my colleagues, to give you this honorary medal. Sorry, which I recovered just a couple of hours ago, and congratulate you very much before we listen to your lecture. Congratulations.
Good afternoon, everyone. First of all, I would like to express my sincere gratitude for inviting me today and for giving us this award, and on behalf of my lab, I thank you very much. So like many others in the room, I am not working on ecosystems per se, although I have to say that my job primarily rely on the biomass, not to produce energy, but just to try to find new medicine and new chemicals, basically, to be able to dissect cellular processes and to understand biology better. And what I mean by that is we exclusively rely on natural products that are being produced by a diverse range of organisms, for most of which are being genetically encoded, and this is very interesting to look into. So most of my colleagues are isolating natural products, characterizing them, trying to understand how they are being made, and we are using them in cell biology. And so because we are interested in chemistry and in biology, in my lab, it is quite important to try to understand what we are dealing with. And for many years, I've been wondering whether there is a difference between chemistry and biology. And if there is one, I've tried to illustrate this by saying that, in our view, nature is dominated by chemically favored processes. And to me, the beauty of biology is while biology is prone to evolution, universal principles of physical chemistry are not, or at least not on the same time scale. Meaning that to make a chemical bond, you need two electrons. You cannot make a chemical bond with one electron. You cannot make a chemical bond with three. It was always like that, and that's not going to change. And it is our opinion that life has evolved mechanisms to circumvent undesired chemistry. And this statement, to me, is quite important because it means that we can use chemistry and we can use natural products and small molecules to perturb cellular processes, to be able to see things that we would not normally see in the absence of them. And so I assume that most of you here in the room know very well, probably better than me, the central dogma of molecular biology, stating that DNA give rise to RNA, which encodes for proteins, and that proteins and RNA are regulating biological processes. And in our view, small molecule is a missing link in this central dogma of molecular biology, because small molecule can regulate most cellular processes, including endocytosis, trafficking, cell signaling, cell division, DNA repair, cell cycle, epithelial to mesenchymal transition, and so forth and so on. And so here I have listed some of the advantages that I see that small molecule can provide in contrast to other strategies that one might be able to use in molecular biology. In particular, you can reach a spatiotemporal resolution that is unique. And by that, I mean that you can treat a cell population, trigger a phenotype, and 5 minutes later, you can wash out your compound and reverse this phenotype. And this resolution is very valuable. Then not only can you get inhibition with small molecule, but you can also have a gain of function. I would like to cite one example, the very popular case of rapamycin, which interacts with FKBP12, and in normal condition, FKBP12 and the mechanistic target of rapamycin mTOR do not interact with one another. However, in the presence of rapamycin, rapamycin interacts with FKBP12, changes conformation, and then this dimer interacts with mTOR. And so it is quite remarkable to have a natural product that is not being produced by humans, that in human will produce the dimerization of two proteins to inhibit it. Also, you have an infinite structural diversity. And talking about numbers, some popular people in Cambridge made the calculation that, in fact, if you take a piece of paper and a pen, you can draw many more structures on paper than there are atoms in the universe available for you to make them. And for chemists, it is quite remarkable because it means that this is endless and you can make molecules. Well, until your imagination runs out. And then finally, you can use natural product or biologically active compound to identify what we call druggable biological target, which can be DNA, it can be RNA, it can be proteins, it can be sugar, lipids, or it can even be metals or full organelles. And finally, once you have this, then you can use this as a basis for the development of new drugs. So talking about small molecule and natural product, I have illustrated some that are probably very popular to you, so I assume that some of you are using some of these. And by this, I'm referring to caffeine, of course. I've seen many of you drinking a lot of coffee today. So what I like about chemistry also is the aesthetics of it and how nice some structures are. And this is why I entered the field of chemistry in the first place. For instance, I like this molecule, cocaine. The shape of it is appealing to me and it is appealing to many of my colleagues. And you will see some other compounds you will look into and you say, okay, that's not that interesting. And people will not try to make them. Talking about making them, the art of chemistry, to my taste, is being able to make bonds and to break bonds between atoms. And while you will see structures, we chemists, we don't see structures, we also see electron density. And once you see electron density, you may be able to exploit electron motion. And if you do that, you can create the bond that you want and you can break the bond that you want. For instance, here, if you look at this compound that is naturally occurring, this cyclopentanone, and if you look at this amine here, the red dots that you see are electrons. And what I know is that here, oxygen is sucking the electrons away from the carbon here, and that this electron will be prone to react to this carbon to create the bond that you see here. And this is chemistry. And once you do this, then you can chemically react this onto another compound that, again, is more electrophilic, meaning that needs electrons. This lone pair here is going to react on this carbon, basically to close the ring here to give rise to this compound. And I will try to tell you what we have done with this compound, which is not naturally occurring, but this is a synthetic small molecule that is biologically active and, in my view, has some remarkable biological properties. All right, so back in the days, back in 2012, if I recall properly, I was working with Steve Jackson. I was on my way out of Cambridge from the Gordon Institute and attempting to set up my lab in Gives-sur-Yvette. And we were interested in a series of proteins, including the lamines, lamine A and lamine C, and hemerin, which compose to some extent the nuclear envelope, meaning that are surrounding the genome, and to some extent also physically protect the genome. And we are interested in it because in cancer and in some orphan disease, there are either mutations that basically disrupt the capacity of these lamines to surround the genome, but can also exacerbate it, such that you lose this nuclear shape. And you know what cancer is about, but you might not know what the Hutchinson-Gilford progeria syndrome is about. You have children for which the average lifespan would be 15 years, and they are prematurely aging because they are accumulating a lot of DNA damage. And this would be the nuclear shape of a cell of these children, and today they are on a cure for these children, and the pain they are going through during their life is just unbearable. And so I was talking about DNA damage. So here we used a specific marker of DNA damage, which is gamma H2AX. Basically, this is a phosphorylation of this variant of histone, which is a nuclear protein around which DNA is wrapped. And all the foci that you see here are sites where you've got single-stranded DNA double-strand break, which also account for cell aging. And then when you treat this cell population with this compound I told you about remodeling, after 12 hours, basically, not only you rescue a normal nuclear shape, but you also start to lose and to decrease this endogenous level of DNA damage. And again, this compound is not abolishing signaling that is leading to DNA damage. It allows cells to physically fix these DNA breaks. So this is a picture, so you have to believe me. So we thought we would make a movie out of it. And here, what you see is cell nuclei here in gray. In fact, these are cells that will recapitulate lamin A mutations. So these are knocked down for lamin A. And you can see the nucleus because we tagged H2B protein with a green fluorescent protein, which allows you basically to do live cell imaging and to monitor where cells are. So what we've done is treat the cell population for 12 hours overnight. We've been taking a picture every 15 seconds, and at the end, we just compiled all these pictures, which give a movie. And you can look at all the cells, but looking at this panel already, you see that there are a lot of nucleus that are misshapen here, here and there, here, here and there. And the most striking one is this one. You might think that these are two cells and two nuclei, but this isn't it, this is just one cell. And you will see what happened after 12 hours of treatment. So after 12 hours of treatment, it was complicated for us to identify a single remaining cell with a misshapen nucleus. Also, we were very happy because we had this phenotype that was quite impressive to us, but we still made the connection or the assumption that the nuclear shape defect was linked to premature aging, and this compound could well have rescued the nuclear shape without rescuing aging as well. So we had to dig deeper, and what we do in chemistry, and this is what we're supposed to be good at, we modified the biologically active compound that you would see here to form some kind of molecular fishing rod to be able to fish out putative target of our compound to try to understand what are the master regulators of aging. And by doing so, we isolate for the first time this N-terminal acetyl transferase 10, which basically is supposed to transfer an acetyl onto some other proteins, which we have not identified yet. But it allowed us basically to manipulate NAT10 in various organisms to see whether we could promote aging or rescue aging. And by doing this experiment, we discovered that NAT10 is a master regulator of the long microtubule dynamics, which you might see here in gray, and you see some that are darker than others. Okay, so these are the long microtubules. So you can see microtubules are at least long microtubules as some kind of molecular ropes linking the nucleus to the plasma membrane. And this gives some kind of, some rigidity to the cell, which also protects the nucleus to some extent. Now, when you treat with remodeling, you see that these long microtubules disappear. And what is interesting is that this compound does not affect the cell cycle at all. So it seems that there is a window of opportunity whereby you can touch a specific pool of microtubules without affecting the function of some other microtubules. And then you can take out endogenous NAT10, and you see that you also lose these long microtubules, and you can complement with wild type, so you rescue long microtubules, or you can complement with mutated NAT10, and then you don't have these long microtubules anymore. And so by doing so, we came up with a proposal that microtubules are pulling the nucleus apart, applying physical forces onto your genome, and if you have a DNA break, basically it will pull your DNA apart, and the cell will have a hard time to kinetically fix these breaks. However, if you treat with remodeling, you lose these long microtubules, so to some extent you lose these forces, and then you allow your cells to fix the breaks quicker. And so we did an experiment with Sanger Institute, which spent quite a few years to develop these mice, whereby you can mutate the lamins to mimic progeria, and then you will have your signs of premature aging. And then you can mutate one of the alleles of NAT10, not both because your mice are not viable, but if you mutate one of them, then you see that you increase the health span of your mice. So this is direct genetic validation of our compound. And then if you do the same experiment, but instead of mutating NAT10, basically you will treat these cells, you will feed your mice with remodeling every day for however long, you have this exact same rescue of cellular aging. And now today we are trying basically to try to convert this compound no longer as a molecular biology probe, because this compound is commercially available from Sigma if you wanted to do some molecular biology, but we're trying to see whether or not we can treat a progeria or we can help children basically to fight against this difficult to deal with mutation. Okay. So that's one example of using natural product or synthetic small molecule in the context of cell biology, molecular biology, and more largely medicine. And there is another aspect, the Curie Institute that we are interested in. Basically, this is the epithelial to mesenchymal transition, which is a process that is involved during development. It is also involved in the immune response, inflammation, wound healing. And some people at the Curie and others have proposed that it is also involved in cancer progression. So if you think about a carcinoma will be composed of many different types of cells, some of which will compose bulk and will proliferate quickly, and some others are more quiescent. And there is a proposal stating that cells can switch from an epithelial to mesenchymal state, meaning that in epithelial state they will attach to one another, and in the mesenchymal state they no longer will attach to one another, but they will have the capacity to leave the site of the primary tumor and to enter the bloodstream and to leave some place else. They will then undergo the reverse process, which is mesenchymal to epithelial transition, and they will give rise to a secondary tumor or metastasis. And the thing is that if you treat primary tumor with conventional drugs, which most of them target hyperproliferation, and this is Taxol, and this will be cisplatin or doxorubicin, what you're actually doing is killing the cells that proliferate a lot, but you're not killing the cells that are proliferating slower, including the mesenchymal cells, and 6 months later, you might end up with a tumor that is smaller, yes, but enriched into these cells with metastatic potential. And so some very smart people, and I would name quite a few, Bob Weinberg, Eric Lander, and Pierre Gupta, and LMPZO to some extent, because he developed a model that was used by these people in Boston. They came up with the idea that if you were to use a cell that was stuck into mesenchymal state and that also recapitulate all the properties of mesenchymal persister cancer cells, then one would be allowed to screen compounds and identify compounds that would specifically target this population of cells. And so they did a screen of 16,000 natural products and synthetic small molecules, which again were going back to the diversity and what the ecosystem can provide us with. And they identified the natural product, salinomycin, which is sodium ionophore, meaning that you've got your natural product here and you've got the sodium here that is being coordinated inside the natural product. Okay, so sodium is a very polar ion, it doesn't enter cells like that. But then your natural product, which is quite lipophilic, create some kind of lipophilic shell around the sodium, which allow the complex to enter cells and to give an increase of sodium concentration, which will kill cells. So this paper was published in Cell in 2009. It is a landmark paper in my view, because this is the first one that really shows that you can target a population of cells that give rise to metastasis. So I think this is a foundational paper. And so for about a decade, people have been trying to understand why sodium is critical to the activity of this compound. And like other people, we asked this question and we could not get our hands on top of this mechanism. And to us, this idea that sodium is important for the biology of mesenchymal cells did not add up. And so we attempted to use this natural product, salinomycin, that you see here, synthesize a large library of this natural product to be able to have compounds that are more potent, allowing us to work at lower concentration and allowing us basically to uncouple sodium transport from an activity against these mesenchymal cancer cells. So now you're looking at this compound. We are not making it because it is too complicated to make. Some people made that before, and that was not the aim. We are actually extracting it from chicken food because it also exhibits properties against parasites. And when you look at this natural product, you will see chemical functions that look like this one. This is an alcohol, like an alcohol that you would drink. Okay, you have one here, and one there. And before I told you that if you're a good chemist, you are supposed to see the electron density of this compound, and you're supposed to be able to exploit the reactivity of some of this alcohol without touching the others, which allows you basically to selectively modify your compound, which is what we've done. So we've been working quite hard on it, and we introduce here what we call propargyl amine. And this propargyl amine is suitable for a chemistry that a lot of biologists are using, and I'm referring to the EDU staining, which allow people to monitor cell proliferation. EDU gets incorporated by DNA in the S phase, and then you can chemically react dye onto DNA, and then you can see which DNA are synthesizing, which cells are synthesizing DNA, and you can then sort your cells. For compound, this is exactly the same. If you don't know where your compound goes in cells, you cannot assign mechanism of action. That's why we developed this chemistry. And by reacting a dye onto this compound inside the cells, we could find that the natural product accumulates into the lysosomal compartment. And to cut a long story short, I will not delve into all the scientific detail, but basically here we found that if you have your persister cells, you've got iron, which is stored in the lysosome, in cytosol, in the nucleus. And our lead compound, which we later call ironomycin, chemically interact with iron inside the lysosomal compartment, which has two consequences. One is to deplete the nuclear pool of iron, which has other consequences that I'm going to explain in a minute. But the most important one is that this complex produces the formation of reactive oxygen species. And this is the undesired chemistry I was referring to before. Persister cancer cells have ways of dealing with reactive oxygen species. And here we are overcoming these mechanisms. And by creating this oxidative stress, basically, we are chemically consuming the membrane of lysosomes, thereby releasing the lysosomal content into the cytosol and killing cells by a process that is known as ferroptosis. Now I'm quite pleased because a lot of other people in parallel to our work have shown that persister cancer cells are vulnerable to this particular ferroptosis cell death pathway as opposed to others. So that's what we have elucidated, but this most importantly has led to three discoveries which I think are more important. The first is why would persister cancer cells be more susceptible to this type of treatment? And we thought that if iron is involved, maybe there is more iron into persister cancer cells compared with the others. And so we used isogenic cell lines, the epithelial population, and we compared to the mesenchymal population, and we could see that there is a 5- to 6-fold increase in iron content. So we said, okay, these mesenchymal cells have an iron addiction. We did another experiment whereby we took this population of cells, the epithelial population of cells that you can see here. You see the echadherin, which is the epithelial marker, the vimentin, which is not being expressed, it is the mesenchymal marker. You see low level of iron, low levels of ferritin, and then you treat this population of cells for 2 weeks with iron, you feed them, and little by little you see that there is a lot of echadherin, you see an increase of vimentin, and you see an increase in ferritin. And this basically shows that not only these cells are taking up iron and storing it, but they are using it basically to repress to some extent echadherin and to re-express vimentin. Okay, so basically if you take a epithelial population of cells and you feed them with iron, some cells are plastic enough to use this metal and to switch to a different state, which we know is a more metastatic or invasive state. So that's the first finding. The second finding, which took us quite a few years, is how iron is being used. And we found two things, but the most important one is iron is not being used by enzymes as a metal cofactor. It is being used as a metal catalyst, and this is very different. A cofactor will help the enzymatic activity. A metal catalyst is actually the atom that is mediating chemical bond making and breaking. Here you will have ketoglutarate, which is non-cometabolite. Here you have iron 2, the metal catalyst I told you about. Here you have molecular oxygen, and around this you have got this enzyme. And this enzyme is, one of them is PHF8. This is a Jumanji domain containing enzyme that is using iron as a metal catalyst to promote the enzymatic demethylation of lysine residues, in particular histone residues. So the metal catalyst is iron, and the cofactor becomes the enzyme in this case. And now this is very important because in cancer, if you have a protein that is overexpressed, if the metal isn't there, the reaction is not happening. And so it is interesting to monitor mRNA levels of proteins or protein level of your usual suspects involved in cancer, but if the metal isn't there, it doesn't work. Here the enzyme is just to stabilize the various degree of oxidation of the metal, switching from an iron 2 to an iron 3 to an iron 4 to an iron 4 to an iron 3 and back to iron 2, which is the definition of a catalyst, which remains unchanged at the end of a chemical reaction. But in the meantime, what you have is the transfer of this molecular oxygen onto the methyl residue through a radical process, and that's how you get rid of the methyl. And by doing so, you can switch a mark that is a repressive histone mark into a mark that is no longer repressing the genes. So now I'm showing you one data that is fresh data. It's a data that we planned 2 years ago with Emmanuel Charaf and Christophe Ginestier in Marseille. So we just got these samples 2 weeks ago, and and this is the result. So we took PDX, so we took two tumors from breast cancer with poor prognosis, tumors that are resistant to Taxol, tumors that have shown signs of metastasis, and most importantly, tumors that are susceptible to treatment with ironomycin, the compound that we've been developing for a few years. We sorted the cells, CD44 low population is here, and CD44 high population is here. So here you have the epithelial part of the tumor, and here you will have the mesenchymal part of the tumor, meaning that if you take the cell population, you try to seed a new tumor with this population that is CD44 low, it doesn't really work. However, if you use the CD44 high population, not only you will have tumor growth, but you will have metastasis. And then we compare, I pass on the detail how we found that, but we compare the levels of proteins of interest to us and some Eastern mark. First off, what we saw is that the ferritin is increased. Okay, so that is interesting because the data I showed you before is a model cell line. This is a primary tumor from a patient. Two, we saw that PHF8 is increased. PHF8 is a Jumanji-containing enzyme that is involved in cancer, and it requires iron as a metal catalyst. So histidine, histidine, and asparagine here is PHF8. Then we looked at this repressive histone mark that form very large domain throughout the gene body, which is H3K9 dimethyl, which is a repressive mark, also known to be a direct target of PHF8. And you see that this mark is reduced in the mesenchymal population of cells. This is very interesting. So that is the second discovery, is that iron is being required as a metal catalyst. Now we did a ChIP-seq experiment to try to identify which were the genes that were repressed by this mark into the PTL state, to try to understand what are the iron-regulated genes in the mesenchymal state of cells. And we found fibronectin, and we found CD44, these two genes. So these two genes are mesenchymal genes. If you look at the H3K9 dimethyl ChIP-seq profile in the epithelial state, you see that the reads count is very high. However, in the mesenchymal state, you see a reduction. This is the second discovery. And now the third one, which goes beyond cancer in my view. I have illustrated here another protein, which is transferrin receptor. And for those who are familiar with iron homeostasis, this data doesn't add up. Why? Because transferrin receptor is a protein at the plasma membrane that is interacting with transferrin that binds iron and that is responsible for iron endocytosis. So now you might ask me, how is it possible that you've got more transferrin receptor in this population and you've less ferritin? Surely it should be the other way around. Now this is very interesting because we came to realize that CD44, which is a protein which is also a plasma membrane protein, which is involved in cancer and inflammation and T-cell activation and wound healing and development. This protein is known to interact with hyaluronate, and hyaluronate contains a lot of carboxylates. And carboxylate is probably the best chemical function that can interact irreversibly with iron as a metal. And what we know is that if you feed tumors with hyaluronate, or in primary tumors, you see overexpression of hyaluronate. And you see metastatic cancer CD44. And so we've shown that CD44 is interacting with iron-bound hyaluronate, which mediate iron endocytosis. And this is interesting because CD44 is the target genes of iron. So we've got this positive feedback loop whereby CD44 is regulating its own expression. And so I would like to finish with this slide, which is not a model that we propose. It's very much a scheme that sums up the data we have, where here you've got the chemistry, and here you've got the biology. So this state basically represents the epithelial state of cells, whereby you've got the canonical iron endocytosis pathway that is at work, which goes through transferrin receptor, interacting with transferrin and iron 3. And when I started this seminar, I told you that cells have evolved mechanism to circumvent undesired chemistry. Now, as you know, if you take a piece of iron, you leave it outside, it is going to rust. The same happens in cells. If you have too much iron, you're going to produce reactive oxygen species. And in healthy cells, you don't need this. You need to have just the right amount of iron that you need. And nature is very well made because nature has evolved mechanism whereby the excess of iron is interacting with the 5' UTR of the messenger RNA of transferrin receptor, such that if you've got too much iron, you block translation and you no longer express this protein, which allows cells basically to maintain a basal pool of iron in the epithelial state. Now in that state, of course, H3K9 dimethyl is high, so these genes are off, and that's fine. Now you can trigger your epithelial mesenchymal transition. And now you might ask the question, if you need a lot of iron and if you are addicted to iron, of course you cannot rely on the transferrin pathway because it is inhibited by iron. And so here you've got iron 3 that is bound to hyaluronate interacting with CD44, then you've got endocytosis of this complex, which in my view is a lot more powerful as well because there are many more sites of binding. Here you've got 2 elements per protein, and here you might have 40,000. Then you've got iron entering your cells. Iron is going to go in mitochondria, which we have shown. It is important for the Krebs cycle and the biogenesis of alpha-ketoglutarate. And then iron goes into the nuclear compartment, whereby you will have this PHF8 enzyme. PHF8 uses iron as a catalyst and ketoglutarate as a co-substrate. And then you reduce the methylation status of these genes. You re-express these genes. And here I've illustrated some of the mesenchymal genes that are the usual mesenchymal marker, CD44, as I told you about, CD109, which is a pro-metastatic gene. And here, the beauty of this mechanism is that you will have negative regulatory feedback loop when you consider transferrin receptor, which is occurring at the translational level. But here with iron, it is a positive regulatory loop acting at the transcriptional level. And so at the onset of EMT, transferrin receptor is enough to start to unlock this gene, and little by little, CD44 is taking over this pathway. And now to finish, the last data, we can manipulate these 4 ways. You can use antibodies basically to block CD44, but that's not enough because in fine you will need to block both pathways, transferrin receptor and CD44. You can use ironomycin here to reprogram the reactivity of the metal by blocking it into the lysosomal compartment, meaning instead of having iron in the nucleus to promote this, you keep it in the lysosome to produce reactive oxygen species and to kill your cells. Or you can use metformin, which blocks the Krebs cycle by interacting with iron and depleting the iron pool from aconitase 2, which is responsible for the biogenesis of ketoglutarate to some extent. Or you can use deferoxamine, which again is a bacterial CD44 that chemically interacts with iron. And by using deferoxamine, you can hijack iron from PHF8 and block this pathway. And that's how you can use natural product and synthetic small molecule basically to manipulate iron homeostasis in the context of EMT and other processes. And now I would like to conclude by thanking all the very talented people working in my lab and my prior supervisors and mentors I was fortunate enough to work with, and I'm referring to Steve Jackson here at the Gerd Institute, Shankar Balasubramanian, who appears to be the inventor of Illumina sequencing, which is the lab where I trained as a postdoc. Jack Baldwin, who is the person who has elucidated the biosynthesis of the penicillins. And back in the day, this was part of my PhD in Oxford. This was the lab of Robinson, which was associated to the lab of the person who discovered the penicillins, which I can't remember the name. And Stuart Shriver, who has, to me, been the most intellectually influential person, is the person who has discovered the biological activity of mTOR. He discovered actually mTOR, but he also discovered the first mammalian HDAC, also using natural product derivatives such as trapoxin and tricostatin. And I will finish by thank you very, very much for your attention, for your participation, and for your confidence in our ideas. Thank you very much.